Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, dubbed the Hip Young Division of the Commonwealth Club, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. My name is Raj Patel. I'm a journalist and author of Stuffed and Starved and The Value of Nothing. And joining me tonight is Arianna Huffington, co-founder and editor-in-chief of The Huffington Post. In her latest book, she sounds the alarm on Third World America, taking on Washington and Wall Street for their abandonment of the middle class. Today, we'll hear from one of modern media's strongest voices as she discusses the disappearing American dream. So please join with me in welcoming Arianna Huffington. So, Arianna, let's get started. You've called this book Third World America, How Our Politicians Are Abandoning the Middle Class and Betraying the American Dream. It's a provocative title, and that's where I want to start. Why did you call it Third World America?
Well, first of all, it's really great to be here. It's great to see many familiar faces in the audience, and great to be listening to Raj. Don't you love his voice? In my next lifetime, I want to have his accent, much better than mine. He also is the most adorable 8-month-old, and his wife is sitting on the front row. So far, we've really bonded over that. But Third World America is obviously a very jarring title. America is clearly not a third world country yet. The reason I chose a very jarring title is because I wanted to sound the alarm. As I was growing up in Athens, Greece, my favorite heroine was Cassandra, because she had the gift of prophecy, but she also had this curse from Apollo not to be believed. And so when she told the Trojans that the Trojan horse was full of Greeks, you know, they ignored her, they didn't believe her, and they let the Trojan horse in. And what happened is it turned out to be proved very dead and very wrong, the Trojans. So I feel that while we have time to course correct, this is the time to sound the alarm. You know, there's no point in sounding the alarm after the iceberg has hit the Titanic. It's good to sound the alarm beforehand. And so if you look at what's happening in this country, you do see the disappearance of the middle class. Right now, you have 100 million Americans who are worse off than their parents were at a similar age. You have 2/3 of Americans who said in a recent survey that they expect their children to be worse off than they are. Now, that is fundamentally un-American. You know, as an immigrant to this country, you know, we came here because we believed in the American dream, and we've lived the American dream. So it's in our upward mobility, it's in our DNA. It's in the American DNA. And so when you now have America be number 10 on the list of countries with upward mobility, you know, behind France and the Scandinavian countries and Spain, there's something wrong. You feel like you should be suing France for copyright violation. It would be as if we were ahead of France in croissants and fine wines and afternoon sex. So I think the fate of the middle class is the primary reason why I feel we're down that wrong path. The state of our infrastructure is another. I have an entire section in the book that I call America the Beautiful / the Dilapidated. Because it's really amazing to see what's happening to our roads, our bridges, our electric pipes. I mean, since we're all in California, we saw what happened recently here when pipes that had not been properly maintained burst and people died and homes were destroyed. Well, that could be happening all around the country. And yet, even at a time of such unemployment, we don't have the political will to have massive infrastructure projects of the kind that we should be engaging in, even if we were at full employment.
But one of the ideas behind a third world, for students of history like yourself, the vision of third worldism was actually a very political idea. I mean, when this idea of a third world, a third worldist vision that was enunciated in 1955 in this big conference of third world states in Bandung was to be able to push forward a vision for positive change. For them, being third world wasn't a pejorative thing to be. It was, in fact, a marker of a progressive a vision for future for the future of emancipation, and that's one of the things that you talk about in the book. And I think we ought to spend our time talking this evening about positive solutions, because of course Cassandra's curse was never to be perpetually ignored. But you've got the Huffington Post, and so the problem that it seems that you face is not that you can't get people to hear you. But that we lack the vision for social change and, as you say, this political will. So talk to us a little bit about how it is that we can get to this political will, having identified what the problems are.
Well, you're absolutely right. And, of course, I always prefer to talk about the solutions. You know, if you want to accept my diagnosis, then we can move to solutions quickly. Section 5 is the solution section of the book, and if you only have time to read one section, please just read Section 5. In fact, if you only have time to read half of Section 5, start on page 199. And I'm giving you the cliff notes. The reason for that is that the first part of Section 5 is about the solutions that need to be started by government. And from page 199 on are the solutions that can be started by each one of us. No matter what government does. And I think it's important to start from there, because otherwise people can get easily frustrated and have the sense that nothing is really changing in Washington, that politicians promise a lot and in the end they don't deliver. And no matter how dysfunctional Washington is, if we can focus on the amazing things happening around the country, community by community, there is an incredible source of optimism. And as I was traveling around the country researching the book and then talking about the book, I was like amazed by the amount of creativity, compassion, generosity, ingenuity that you see all around the country. And if you can add all that, if you can add to all that social media and the power of social media, it's really amazing how we can much more easily scale up the good things happening. If you go, for example, to Etsy.com, you see how many people who've given up trying to get a job are now creating their own jobs. You know, they're taking their passions and their hobbies and turning them into livelihood. If you go to Swap.com, you have people literally swapping things. You want a refrigerator, I want a laptop, we can find each other online. And it's just amazing also to see people who are out of work, who are recognizing that the one thing they have is an abundance of time and often skills, and how can they activate them? One of my favorite stories in the book is the story of Seth Reams, who lost his job as a concierge in Portland, Oregon. And after filing 300 job applications and not getting another job, he started a site called WeVeGotTimeToHelp.org, and he brought together people who are unemployed or underemployed with people in need. And what was amazing is that it changed the way he looked at himself. You know, he no longer looked at himself as a victim, as somebody who was an unproductive member of society. He began to feel very empowered. Then I wrote about him, and I started talking about him wherever I went, on Jon Stewart, on Bill Maher. I would talk about Seth. I got friends of mine to put him on television. So now he has 100 cities that want to start WeVeGotTimeToHelp.org in their cities. He emailed me the other day. He said, Arianna, he said, I'm so busy. I still don't have a job, but I've never been busy. And we've set him up with in a not-for-profit. This is just one example. And, okay, he is somebody who was a concierge, but there are people without a job who are lawyers and doctors and have a lot of skills, and they can use them. Like, there's this incredible movement that started in Philadelphia of unemployed and underemployed lawyers who are using their skills to help people avoid foreclosure. So all I'm saying is that we obviously need to create jobs. You know, we can't continue down this path of having almost 27 million people out of work or underemployed. But in the meantime, what we do is going to be critical to how quickly we truly revive the country. And that's why the first step in my solutions chapter starts with what we do ourselves, like tapping into our own personal strength and resilience. Because you see that hard times have a very different impact on people. Some people are crushed by them, and some people discover parts of themselves they didn't even know they had and thrive through them. So that's, for me, the first step. I have 7 steps, so I won't go through all of them right now.
But I think maybe it's important to figure out what some of those bigger steps are. Because, for example, in Seth's case, if he's still unemployed, maybe his benefits will carry on. But as you note in the book so very well, you know, the 99ers, the people who have run out of 99 weeks of unemployment benefit, and now, of course, that's failed to have been reauthorized, right. And that's running out on November 30th, at least as far as we know. What about them? There's only so much resilience that one can have, particularly if one doesn't have the resources. I mean, there was a report recently that came out, particularly observing that the amount of resources one has depends or is contingent on things like race, for example. Single African-American and Latino women have a net wealth of zero compared to white women, single family households, that have a net wealth of, say, about $6,000. I mean, it's not a huge discrepancy. Single-headed households headed by women in the U.S. are systematically more likely to go hungry. But there is still a difference in the amount of resilience that families have depending on the amount of wealth that they have. Now, for families that wouldn't classify themselves as middle class, these are very dark times. What about them?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. These are incredibly hard times. And as we're sitting here focusing on what individuals and communities can do, let me just say that at no point can we let government off the hook, because there's no question that the fact that unemployment benefits were not reauthorized for the 99ers and beyond is really tragic. And it's such an incredible statement about our country at the moment, that while we are spending $2.8 billion a week in Afghanistan, pursuing a war that is not in our national security interest, while we are propping up a corrupt regime and allowing our young men and women to die and spending money we do not have in pursuit of this war, we are not reauthorizing unemployment benefits. So there is a fundamental disconnect here that we need to obviously be exposing every day. And at the Huffington Post, of course, that was a huge splash headline today. And we are continuing to do everything we can to put flesh and blood on precisely the dark times that we are describing. In fact, we have 2 reporters whose only job is to do nothing other than putting flesh and blood on the data. Because while you may not really feel particularly bad about the number 27 million people out of work or underemployed, you will feel bad if you hear the specific stories. You know, there's something about the human story that can touch our hearts and our minds, and we need to do more of that in order to capture the public imagination to demand fundamental change in Washington.
And is that what the role that you see Huffington Post playing? I know many writers and particularly many progressives see it as an island of sanity in the online world of the information overload. But the Huffington Post is a funny place, right? It's on the one hand, of course, that there are fantastic articles that deal, for example, with. I saw something the other day about the economic injustices that women face and whether women can define beauty on their own terms. And then there are articles about Katy Perry wowing everyone at Victoria's Secret with photos. And so I wonder what you see the role as Huffington as the Huffington Post as being.
Well, the Huffington Post, as we say in our tagline, is the first internet newspaper. So we cover everything. We have now 26 sections. So we have we cover exhaustively everything that's happening in politics, everything that's happening around the world, and we're also covering Britney Spears. And we're also, just launched our latest section on divorce. Nora Ephron is the founding editor. And that's a very, very deliberate editorial decision. Our goal is not just to talk to people who agree with us. Our goal is to talk to the world, because I don't believe change happens by just talking to people who agree with you. And so if people want to come to the Huffington Post to watch the Victoria's Secret model, and then they happen to also see the fact that unemployment benefits were not extended, I think that's a good thing. Because we don't want to create sort of little niches where you have the Fox niche and the MSNBC niche and the Victoria's Secret niche and the Donald Trump niche. And then, we will fail to communicate even more than we are failing to communicate now. So we are very deliberately and unapologetically a mixture of highbrow and lowbrow. And if you don't want to go lowbrow, you don't have to. Nobody forces you to click on the pictures of the Victoria's Secret model. And also, if you are connected to our social news with Facebook Connect, and your friends see what you click on, and you want to click on one of those stories you don't want your friends to know you are clicking on, you can put it on the stealth mode.
So given that's the vision is really to recruit. And to bring people to a sort of broader consciousness about what's happening in politics. What's the next step? One of the things that one might say is, well, all right, we've got these people. What do we do? Where are we? How are we going to move forward? And of course, third world America is, it seems to me, a moment in which that might happen. But sometimes people need to organize. And one of the things that's happened recently is the Rally to Restore Sanity. And I wonder if you talk a little bit about that, because you were a fan, and it seems like that
And
might...
you weren't. I read what you wrote on the Huffington Post.
I enjoyed myself immensely, but I had problems with it. But I'd like you to talk a little bit about why you enjoyed it so much.
Well, what happened is that, first of all, I was on Jon Stewart's show to talk about Third World America, and in the green room, he said to me, I don't know how all these people are going to get to Washington, And then when I was on the air with him, in a moment of irrational exuberance, and I swear I had not thought about it beforehand, I said to him and the audience, I said, if you want to go to Washington from New York, just come to our office in Soho. I gave our address. And we'll have buses to take you to Washington. And... In fact, Vina Singh, who is here, his dad is our managing editor, and he was in the green room together with some other editors, and I got back, and they asked me if I knew what I'd said. And two of our editors went back to the office, and they created a sort of sign-up sheet online, and by the next day, we had a few thousand sign-ups, and we clearly realized that we could not have them come to Soho. So we ended up having 200 buses, over 10,000 people. We all met at 5 in the morning at Citi Field and went to Washington. Let me just say something before I say something about the rally, how absolutely amazing it was. I was there at 5 o'clock greeting everybody, and I was amazed. People had come from all around the country, and they had chosen to come to New York to get Washington. The funniest thing was one man who said to me, you know, I just came from Washington to take the bus to go to Hawaii. And I said to him, this is an act of insanity in the name of restoring sanity. But the point was that what I realized, which honestly I had no idea until I saw what was happening, was that this was a pilgrimage, that people wanted to be together for the journey. They didn't want to just be together for the rally. And when we say be together, these were people who were not even talking to each other about who they were going to vote for or what political party they were from. They had the sense that we needed to be all in this together if we're going to get out of the dark times we're in. And that there was something about our humanity and the fact that we're all in this together in some very fundamental, profound way that we needed to rediscover. And there were people who had brought donuts for their bus and people who had made little bracelets to hand out to their fellow bus travelers. And, you know, there was this amazing control. You know, the people who had, we had brought on, who came on, and they didn't charge us anything to organize this whole thing because it was a big production. They had arranged for security, you know, they were afraid there might be people bringing guns or drugs or whatever. You know, we felt responsible for the people who were coming. It was so completely peaceful and safe. There wasn't a single incident. And so for me, that was an amazing moment. Now, I know that because I read your piece, that Raj, that you were saying that John Stewart didn't call on anybody to go vote. And that was not what the rally was about. You know, the rally was really about what he said in his speech, which was that while the media are focusing on what is not working in the country, every day there are millions of acts of us coming together and making things work. So can we take our magnifying glass, those of us who are in the media and have a magnifying glass, and also put it on what is working in the country? Because that gives us the sense of possibility about how we can turn lives and communities around.
And I think that's right. I mean, I also felt that amazing sense of community. And also, I spoke to a number of people there, and for almost all of them, it was their first time ever at a political rally. And they were coming because they genuinely wanted to make a change. And I think that that's what was missing for me, is the sense that, well, all right, what next? I mean, it's true that every day, in many ways, you know, we all drive on the same side of the street and we all figure out how to let people ahead of us as we funnel into a tunnel. But there's the kind of political cooperation that clearly is lacking in Washington that people were pining for. And there wasn't really a way from the rally to get to that. Now, of course, you know, it would be absurd to ask Comedy Central to chart that out for us. But on the other hand, to at least let the specter of politics be raised, I think wouldn't have been a bad thing. And of course, you know, it was a recruiting opportunity, right? I mean, there were a lot of groups that were out there that were signing people up for various causes, and there were various sort of political interest groups out there. But I still wonder whether, I mean, was the rally just about did everyone come there really just to critique the media, or did people want more?
No, I think the rally was really, I mean, it was about many things, like everything like that, but I think primarily it was about some kind of recognition, conscious by some, unconscious by others, that in times of deep economic anxiety, in times of deep economic hardship for millions of people, there is an incredible tendency to demonize and scapegoat. And it is much easier to do that and to appeal to the worst in us when we are afraid. And millions of people are afraid. Even if they still have their jobs, they're afraid they may lose them. Even if they still have their jobs, they're afraid that their kids may not have jobs. So I've seen that again and again. I was speaking recently in Atlanta to the Coca-Cola employees. And now these are pretty stable jobs. Coca-Cola is doing very well. And yet, after my speech, I had a woman say to me, you know, I have a stable job, I have a good salary, my sister, who is a single mom with two children, has lost her job, and my paycheck has to stretch to take care of them. So you have, basically, everybody has been affected. So even if people have not been directly affected, they've been affected because somebody they love, somebody in their family, a close friend has been affected. So that creates huge economic anxiety in the country. And so during those times, it's imperative that we do everything we can to tap into the better angels of our nature while everything else is tapping into our basest instincts. It's almost like a race against time. So for me, that was a rally to help us tap into what is best in us. And we need to keep it up. And, you know, it's not a... But that's our job.
But how do we do that?
I think we each need to do that. I mean, that's why I'm saying that there are things in our communities that are happening all the time. We need to decide what do we want to join or who do we want to start. You know, either is possible. And we can start by looking at what's online. We can start by looking what's in our own communities. There's so much happening. And that's why at the Huffington Post, we started a new feature that we are calling the greatest person of the day, where we are spotlighting people who are doing things in their communities. And we put them on the front page, and we put the spotlight on them. And then we started an interactive map where we put all the good things that we find, and please send us. I'll give you my email address, ariana@huffingtonpost.com, or go to our site and post them directly. And we put a star on the map of America, wherever good things are happening. And that is not to minimize the bad things happening. You know, we're not a good news site. You know, we have plenty of bad news. But our point is to try to do whatever we can do while we are putting the spotlight on the dysfunctionalities and the need for government to take the right actions to encourage people to be doing what we can without just waiting by the sidelines. Democracy is not a spectator sport.
Right. And in fact, that brings me back to the beginning, because not many people know this about us, but we weren't born in America. And there are some interesting things happening in
Europe.
You're
supposed not to tell them.
I know, I'm sorry. I'd rather let it out of the bag now. There are some interesting things happening in Europe in terms of the way that communities are responding to similar kinds of situations that we're seeing in the United States. I mean, are there sort of stars that you would put outside the United States, for example? Are there things happening in Europe right now that you think we can learn from here?
Well, I think that even though I don't agree with a lot of the austerity measures of the David Cameron government in England, I think what they are doing, what they are calling their big society emphasis, you know, what they are basically doing by emphasizing what is happening in their communities that's working, is very significant. I think it's very important that we elevate volunteerism and service to something major. That it's not just noblesse oblige and 1,000 points of light and all those things that people do around Thanksgiving when we go serve meals in homeless shelters. It's something which can be filled with creativity and which can really turn the country around. Not just by putting together all these individual acts and scaling them up, but by also tapping into our own compassion, which I think will make what happened today when unemployment benefits were not reauthorized much harder. You see, right now, we are basically rewarding a fundamental kind of meanness. And so if we can turn that around at the individual and community level, I think it's going to have a huge impact at the political level as well.
But one of the criticisms of, for example, the big society in Europe, in Britain, is that basically it's the state shuffling off its duties of care onto the shoulders, particularly the people least able to manage it. And that's been part of a trend. I mean, in Britain, this idea of the big society was presaged by Margaret Thatcher with something called care in the community. And a similar thing happened in the United States, where in order to cut costs in the National Health Service, the mentally ill were released from the state's duty of care and sent out into the community because the community could take care of mentally ill people better than the government could. At least that was the theory. And I mean, in a sense, we can chart the decline of both upward mobility in the UK and a decline in the level of empathy between people. You talk in your book, you use Jeremy Rifkin's idea of the empathic civilization, which I think is a terrific idea, except that the data suggests that increasingly young people now are less empathic than they were a decade ago and even less empathic than the decade before that. So what I worry about is that, in fact, one of the turns in this, you know, the state disavowing itself of its responsibility is, in fact, generating this meanness that you're talking about. That, in fact, one of the problems with the big society is that it destroys our idea of a collective self and makes it all about communities and individuals.
Well, I don't think it's either or. I think that, in fact, this for me could be the real convergence. When we talk about bipartisanship, for me, bipartisanship, the true bipartisanship, is not about splitting the difference. It's about finding where we can converge. And I think liberals need to recognize that their responsibility does not stop when they ask for government to do something, because that's something that liberals have been responsible for. You know, it's the delegating our compassion to government is not enough either. It's not enough to say, let's spend more on this and more on that, and I'm just going to just watch you do it. And, of course, in the same way, conservatives cannot just say, well, we're just going to cut everything and let the private sector take care of it. Maybe it will, maybe it won't, you know, but at least we'll just see what happens. So neither of these positions makes sense. But the opposite, which is for liberals and conservatives to agree to the fact that, whether out of compassion or out of the sense that the private sector is responsible for taking care of those in need, whatever your starting point is, you can converge around the fact that we all need to do more. So that for me is the true synergy that we can achieve. And again, let me just repeat, and if you read the book, you'll see that I repeat it endlessly, that this is not in any way to let the government off the hook. Mm-hmm. It is simply to recognize that while we have the government that we have in Washington at the moment, everything that we can do can make a difference in people's lives and also in the general atmosphere that we all inhabit.
And of course, you in the solution section, you talk about one of the major impediments to actually getting government to listen to ordinary American citizens on the left or the right, and that's the influence of big money in Washington. I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit about what it is where you see that we can reverse that trend and how we can stop that.
Yeah, and incidentally, I actually see it as beyond left and right. Mm. One of the things at the Huffington Post that we are trying to change the debate around is the fact that the media reflexively look at every issue as left versus right. But in fact, if you look at the key issues of our time, you can't divide them as left versus right. Like Afghanistan, that I've already mentioned, you have major conservatives like George Will and Pat Buchanan and Joe Scarborough and Richard Haass, the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, basically opposing what's happening in Afghanistan. And yet the media keep calling it all as the left wants to leave Afghanistan. You could have 3,000 conservative intellectuals wanting to leave Afghanistan, and the media would still call it the left. Now, the problem with that is that immediately it marginalizes the position as just these extremists, instead of looking at it on its own terms. In the same way, if you look at Wall Street and redefining capitalism, I mean, I have many friends of mine who are card-carrying capitalists who sleep with... You've seen the card, right? Who sleep with copies of Ayn Rand's Fountainhead under their under their pillows, who are incredibly upset by what's happening, who think that bailing out banks that are too big to fail with taxpayer money is not capitalism. You know, the capitalist system is not based on using taxpayer money to bail out those who take excessive risk. You know, according to the capitalist system, you let them fail. So, you know, that there's an enormous amount of redefining that has to be done. That is not easily divided into left versus right. And if we divide it into left versus right, we are not going to find any solutions.
But then... this round of applause.
Thank you. I say that until I'm blue in the face. In fact, we have a tagline at the Huffington Post that we call Beyond Left and Right. And whenever, let's say, George Will comes out against Afghanistan... or anything happens that makes it clear this is not a left-right position, we splash it on the top as a process of re-educating the public in the ways we think about these issues.
Well, of course, and that gets us back to the sort of the media spin on how it is that in particular positions that are progressive in one way or another tend to be ascribed as minority positions, even though we see a lot of evidence that, for example, the debate around healthcare, the majority of Americans, when sort of offered the choice, were in favor of single payer. Now, why is it that this sort of left-right split persists, do you think? I mean, what's going on behind the sort of perpetual left-right division when, in fact, the position of many Americans tends in some cases, to be very firmly conservative and in other ways very firmly to the left, but there doesn't seem to be a way of articulating the nuance?
Well, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. You see that even in the endless polling numbers that have been mention about Obamacare, as it's come to be known. A lot of the people who oppose Obamacare oppose it because it does not include a public option. You know, they oppose it because it is not going to reduce costs in the way it should reduce costs because we gave up so much already to the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry. We even gave up the right to negotiate for bulk purchasing. I mean, can you imagine that? We gave that up before we did anything else. The White House did. So people know that. So they may not know all the details, but they know this is not the best bill we could have gotten. And so it is being opposed by many people from across the political spectrum. But when you look at the polling numbers, the way they are presented as just opposing it because it's a big government takeover. In fact, the main reason for the big anti-government feeling right now is that government has spent hundreds of billions of dollars, including on two wars, and it has done a lousy job. I mean, this is not a good time to be pro-government, unfortunately, because government has been incompetent. It has bailed out people who should not have been bailed out without strings attached. It has bailed out Wall Street, and then Wall Street turned out and failed to return the favor when it came to Main Street. And it has prosecuted two wars that basically were not in our national security interest and put them on our credit card. And so if you want to make a case against government, you have a lot of evidence right now.
And there's the counter argument that, for example, without this government intervention, things would have been much worse.
I'm not saying that the case against government is legitimate. All I'm saying is that there is a lot of evidence to justify it, and I'm saying that government could have done an infinitely better job bailing out Wall Street. I'm not saying they shouldn't have bailed them out, but they should have bailed them out with major strings attached, with major conditions, with clawbacks. With clear ground rules, there would be no bonuses. With clear ground rules about how much they had to lend to small businesses to create jobs, instead of which they cut lending by $100 billion. They should have, on another front, just... You said you wanted to talk about solutions, but let me just tell you something else. You know, you had... In the middle of this epidemic of foreclosures, while the banks had been proven to have basically brought about this near collapse of the financial system, they were powerful enough to basically kill cramdown legislation, which would have prevented tens of thousands of people from losing their homes. And Dick Durbin, Senator Durbin, who was the major proponent of this cramdown legislation, actually said, threw his arms up in the air and said, the banks own this place. So that's really why people are so frustrated with the way the system has worked.
We're going to carry on the conversation in just one second, but we're going to be taking your questions soon, so please start lining up at the mic and rehearsing an incredibly short, pointed, and intelligent question. You can use me as a model if you like. But we won't be taking those questions just yet, but in just a couple of more minutes. So rehearse and to the point, please. But Ariana, so what I'm also hearing here, though, is that clearly President Obama came to power with the idea of hope, and he was sold as the second incarnation of the great communicator. But he seems rather manifestly to have failed to communicate. And I'm wondering if that's why you call one of the ideas towards the end of your book Hope 2.0. Are you taking a jab at Obama's failed hope?
Well, I'm not taking a jab the way Sarah Palin did about Hoppy Changey. How is that Hoppy Changey thing working out, she said. I'm actually acknowledging the fact that hope did not exactly turn out to be what we thought it would be.
It wasn't what we hoped.
It wasn't what we hoped, exactly, to coin a phrase. So it's time for Hope 2.0. And Hope 2.0 is basically about looking in the mirror and finding the leader in the mirror. It's almost as though we need to grow up. You know, all of us, especially women, have this hope as we're growing up that, thank you so much, that a day will come when a knight in a shining armor is going to ride into our lives and save us. And now we're growing up and realizing that day will never come. And that it's time for us to look in the mirror and discover our own leadership potential and just basically save ourselves and save a few other people in the process. And that's really where we are. And we might as well acknowledge it. And this is almost a time for the nation to grow up. And it's a time to also reevaluate what our lives are about. And that's happening a lot. A lot of people who thought life was about endless consumption are reevaluating that. Do you know that during the good times, quote unquote, renting private storage was one of the high growth industries because people were buying so much stuff they didn't have room to put in their apartments. They were renting private storage to put them in. So there's a lot of reevaluation going on right now. And in that process, if you look at what's happening in the zeitgeist, to use that overused German word, there is a shift from what Jonas Salk called Epoch A to Epoch B. Epoch A was about competition and survival, and Epoch B is about collaboration and meaning. And in fact, Raj, contrary to what you said, a lot of young people are actually more empathetic than ever. If you look at the numbers here in this country, there are long waiting lists for people to work for Teach for America. You know, Ivy League students wanting to go work in the inner city rather than work at Goldman Sachs, which used to be the culmination of all good things until Matt Taibbi started writing about Goldman Sachs in Rolling Stone.
Before we take the question, there was something there that I found a little depressing, which is that you're saying that all right, we're not going to be swept off our feet and taken off on a white stallion on a happy ride with fluffy clouds and things. But is the alternative really just to save ourselves and a small band of our community? I mean, one of the ideas that was important in the founding of America and certainly in the building of an industrial manufacturing base, which you, the demise of which you lament in the book, was unions. And yet in the book, the only time that unions come up is the teachers' union, which you don't particularly like. And I'm wondering whether you think that there's a role for unions in as offering a kind of solidarity, as offering a vision for a bigger kind of America than we've seen so far.
Oh, Raj, let me just make it very clear. I don't mean when I say looking in the mirror that we just have to look in the mirror and save our own household or the three houses next to us. You know, you can look in the mirror and decide that you want to start a trade union, or you want to look in the mirror and decide that you want to run for office and go and campaign for better government. Mm. You know, this could be very big. All I'm saying is that we should not just say, my job is to vote every 4 years. Right, right. and then sit back and wait for the person I voted for to change things. That's really the distinction I'm making. And yes, absolutely, I believe in trade unions. At the same time, it's hard to avoid the fact that even though teachers should be absolutely revered, teachers' unions have been an obstacle in many instances when they have decided that teachers should be retained no matter how good or bad they are. So instead of rewarding performance, they reward tenure. And, you know, when you have only one in 2,500 teachers losing their job compared to, say, one in every 70 lawyers or doctors or other professions, there is something going wrong. I mean, I don't know if you've seen Waiting for Superman, but it's very powerful to see, you know, what we've done in many schools in this country.
Well, I will be rewarding brevity and concision and wit in these questions, so I will be... this is purely a merit-based system here. So please keep it short, keep it pointed.
Thanks very much for the presentation, Ariane. And I'd like to take exception with your point that we don't need an option or an alternative to conservative America. I feel that we don't have a strong left, and that's our problem. We're not organized and we have no vision. So I would propose that if you could boil... Conservative economics to the simple emotion of greed and self-righteousness or self-orientation versus a progressive frame of the commons or the common good or goodness, we need to call conservatism out because they're playing hardball to unravel all of the infrastructure of America and privatize it. And I'd like your response to us starting to mature to be governing, to mature in our thinking that we can present an alternative to this rabid, self-righteous conservatism.
Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I never said that we should not be offering an alternative. I'm offering many alternatives in the book, and... many alternatives to the idea, for example, that our economy can work without sufficient regulations, or the fact that we can move from a country that makes things to a country that makes things up, which is what has happened.
If I could interrupt you, may you address the problem that we on the left, and I would characterize that as anybody who is anti-conservative. Why are we incapable of developing a strong movement for the commons, for the public good?
Well, there are many people who are working for that. There are many people who are speaking out for that, who are writing for that, and who want to prioritize what you call the common good, the public interest, over special interests. I mean, that's at the heart of any good government.
And if anyone would like to email me, it's publicgood@earthlink.net.
Would you mind? Thank you.
I wrote some of my question comment down so I could say it succinctly. So my thought is I am really not sure, even now in this particular go-round after this administration and the voting, I am not sure how much effect a person, a good person, can really have. And I and another woman, amazingly, started a very successful campaign that led to an amendment being attached to the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill. We actually were able to get the FDIC to refund $270 million in deposits for depositors whose accounts were taken over in 2008. And that corrected some of the really egregious behavior on the part of the FDIC. But what troubled me was looking at how the FDIC functioned and was allowed to function in a 20-year period, to the extent that even now in the financial reform era, you still don't have on the FDIC website, all accounts are insured under umbrella limits and not each account separately. Just that one simple thing. My question is, these agencies seem to be so dysfunctionally, intrinsically, how much good can an individual do, even the people that you're mentioning? That's my question.
Thank you. I mean, obviously, individuals, even in the dysfunctional system that you are describing, can do an enormous amount of good. I mean, look at Elizabeth Warren, if we want to stay in the financial arena. You know, she was able to prevail when it came to the creation of a consumer protection agency. And by being appointed at least an interim head, she's working hard to create a real consumer protection agency that will fight for the middle class. Now, that may seem like a small victory compared to all the things that have not been done, but it could be a very significant victory as we are creating a real regulatory system to deal with credit card abuses and mortgage abuses and a lot of the things that I'm sure you're very familiar with.
Hi, Ariane. Thank you so much for your inspirational message and your sense of urgency. My name is Joseph. I'm with a startup that's working on technology to reduce inequality. So here's a question for you. $3 billion was spent on political ads this election cycle. Had this money instead been invested in startups, it would create over 100,000 jobs. Do you have any suggestions on how to convert some of this political money that may move us right or left into startup investment money to move us forward?
Well, that's a great question, especially given how awful a lot of these ads were. I think I must say that the I'm Not a Witch ad by Christine O'Donnell must rank somewhere up there. In what were they thinking? But, you know, unfortunately, or fortunately, we are living in a free country and we cannot dictate how people spend their money. I think what you mentioned, though, about the importance of startups is critical because it's not just small businesses that create jobs, it's really new businesses. I mean, the Huffington Post started with 5 people in 2005, and we now have 190. I know it does not solve the unemployment problem in this country. But it's indicative of what happens with new businesses. If they work, you know, they end up really producing jobs. And that's why we started in our business section a small business blog to, again, try and put the spotlight on the creation of small businesses and encourage people to start the process and encourage government to put in place as many incentives as possible for the creation of jobs by small businesses. And in fact, we also started a campaign that we call Move Your Money, encouraging people to move their money from big banks that are not lending to community banks and credit unions that are much more likely to lend in their communities. And we actually got 2 million people to move their money. And so we need to continue that movement and encourage pension funds and union funds to move their money.
Thank you.
Hello. I have a question. I would love to get a sense of what you think of the idea of requiring public airwaves to be provided for free, with whatever way you want to structure, to ballot-qualified candidates, and what do you think the impact would be on American politics?
I'm very much in favor of that because I think that anything we can do to diminish the power of money in our political system would be extremely valuable. And it's really great to see the fact that money is not determinative, the fact that Meg Whitman spent what she spent and did not get elected certainly sends a message.
Or Linda McMahon. That's my favorite loss.
But the fact is that if the airwaves were free, if candidates did not have to spend what they have to spend, especially in a state like California, they would not have to devote as much time as they are devoting to raising money.
Or accepting corporate dollars within the election cycle?
Or basically accepting money that and then owing something back.
Thank you.
The rise and the heyday of the U.S. middle class was founded on the fiction of unlimited cheap fuel and unlimited cheap resources from the global south. What we're seeing now as the result of that is global warming. The latest and most reliable data available to us from the most responsible thinkers we have says that even if we implemented every technology available to cut carbon emissions and to reduce fossil fuel consumption and eliminate dependence on fossil fuels, we cannot reverse global warming. We're past the point of no return. So essentially, we're all on the Titanic. The people in the global south are already drowning. Those of us in this room are on the top deck and have the privilege of rearranging the deck chairs and examining our menu options. Mm-hmm. My question is, how do we actually wake up the U.S. population from a nostalgic, nationalistic dream of a return to that heyday of the middle class to the reality of being on the Titanic and the suffering of those on the lower decks? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. You actually, back in 2001, together with some friends, we launched the Detroit Project, which was trying to wake people up to the dangers of our dependence on oil. In fact, we linked our oil consumption not just to global warming, but also to our national security. And look at what happened. You know, Detroit turned a blind eye and instead spent billions of dollars to basically buy public policy. And we saw the results. So there is no question that what has happened recently the reluctance to accept the scientific evidence about the reality of global warming has made things even harder. And instead of, say, using this opportunity, which the crisis presented us with, to really invest in a new economy based on renewable energy, we saw the Obama administration say that we can basically turn the clock back. And just before the BP oil collapse, say that we can actually go back to offshore oil drilling. So I'm not very optimistic, I'm sorry to say, about what we're doing in that area.
We have time for maybe one, possibly two questions, depending on how speedy you are, sir.
I'd like to think Bill Maher or John Stewart would be clever enough to ask this question. Do you think that the Koch brothers, Koch Industries, their money is behind the conspiracy to keep Bristol Palin on Dancing with the Stars? Edit out that one part, please. Non-trivial question, I'd like to say.
No. I like the question. I just think that, you know, the big money, like the Koch brothers' money, can fuel what's happening, but it's not behind, say, the Tea Party movement or the explosions of popular anger. I think there is legitimate anger. And then that money comes in and uses that legitimate anger to fuel it and to channel it in the way that they've done. But the anger is legitimate.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you so much for coming. It seems like the major stumbling block that we've been discussing so far is division. The corporatocracy would love to divide us and keep us divided so we never get anything done. So my question is, how do we turn the tables against them? How do we do that to them? Have an economic background, and have you talked to any economists lately to see how we can turn the tables on them? Because here in Silicon Valley, we have Facebook, Google, Apple all competing, all creating jobs, and, you know, wages are all going up. And so what is your insight on how we can turn the table? How can we divide them up and have them compete against each other more vigorously?
Well, I think the most important thing is to recognize that the financial sector is there to enable the real economy. It's not there to become an alternative to the real economy. And unfortunately, what we've seen has happened is that the financial sector, which has become about sort of gambling and a casino mentality. I mean, there's even a new book by Joan Nocera that is focusing on exactly what is being done, is really undermining the real economy. And if we want to see jobs created, we need to really stress the need for the financial sector to go back to its original place, which was as an enabler rather than as the taker of excessive risk to be bailed out by the taxpayer.
I'm sorry, but we've run out of time for questions. But I wonder, Arianna, there is one last question, and it is part of the newly founded Inforum tradition of 2010 that we're asking all our speakers the following question. So, Arianna Huffington, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
My 60-second idea to change the world is getting enough sleep. I seriously believe that we are suffering from the fact that many of our leaders are incredibly sleep deprived and as a result making lousy decisions. I'm also convinced that if Lehman Brothers were, for example, Lehman Brothers and Sisters, getting more sleep, they would still be around. Because what we are suffering from is not a lack of IQ, but a lack of wisdom. And if we are more connected with our own wisdom, less sleep deprived, and more able to operate from deeper and wiser parts of ourselves, then we would be making the kind of decisions we need to make as individuals and as a culture. So, time to go get some sleep.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's continue to give a big round of applause to Arianna Huffington for sharing her insights with us tonight. Thank you. And my name is Raj Patel, telling you that this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Thank you.